Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Adam Barrett. You're on the line if we have all the wires connected correctly.
Yes, they are. How are you doing, Fred?
Oh, yeah, there you are. Good. You know, in our last episode, we talked about reliability training and awareness and things like that. But we kind of left it at a spot where, you know, we've used a couple of examples where sometimes the group you're working with really gets reliability engineering. And it's same for various topics. I once worked with a group that really understood statistics and design of experiments. And it was just kind of built into their DNA. Everybody knew that. And it was a strength you could build on. But what the idea, though, and you and I have talked about it in the past, I think our early on episodes, we talked about culture and the different sources of culture, the rice farmer versus wheat farmer kind of thing. But there's different types of reliability cultures within organizations, which is pretty fluffy at the moment. But do you know what I mean? I'm sure you've seen this. Maybe you can describe it a little more clearly than I'm struggling with.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see. And if you're involved with an organization over a long period of time, you can kind of watch that, you know, evolution of it as it changes. If you can get the full organization involved, even, you know, marketing and business units, you can begin to see how they figure out how to have input as to how engineering should balance, you know, reliability needs versus others. But yeah, reliability culture is a huge thing, especially in the U.S., because even engineers are unfamiliar with it. You know, it's not a discipline that was even a choice to take courses in when they were doing their degrees, very likely.
That's right. And I've seen that every now and then. I teach a course at the University of Maryland, and every now and then I get a nuclear engineer or a chemical engineer that wants to take my course. And I don't have formal prerequisites for it, but I just ask them, do you know what FMEA, HALT, and ALT is, and can you describe the differences? And if they can't do that, and these are graduate students in chemical engineering or, you know, or nuclear engineering, and if they can't clearly describe those, I don't let them in the course because they will struggle. They don't understand reliability engineering very well in the tools and techniques and so on. But within an organization, we talked a little bit in our last session about how important it is for electrical, mechanical, the engineers within your organization and managers to understand at least the language that we use for putting together a reliability plan, for example. You know, what's the goals? What's the risk? How do you state the goals? What are the different tasks, types of activities you would do, and how do they fit together? Those concepts can be dramatically different in some organizations, from no idea what you're talking about to it's talked about and discussed at very high levels and fairly well understood. But what makes that difference?
I think it's simply the leadership and how much the leadership values those practices. If they are able to connect whatever the pains are at the other end for not, you know, having set goals for reliability and made time and resource to implement the tools that are going to help them achieve those goals, if they haven't done that, you know, nobody else can do that. They won't, you know, the structure, the basic fundamental structure of the program isn't there to support it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I really feel it's the leadership.
So they have to go through the dark days of poor reliability first? Is that what you're saying?
A lot of it comes from there. You know, it's a lot of, unfortunately, you know, it's reliability to connect to the bottom line, right? And mm-hmm. So for that reason, usually you have to experience what a tremendous order of magnitude it can hit your bottom line before you understand it, you know? And so, yeah, unfortunately, the people involved, maybe that company not personally has experienced it, but the people who are driving it have experienced it. And some of that is our lack of education, you know, both formally and in industry on the topic, right? Because that's the other way to learn, is to listen to other people's experiences and, you know, to see all these tools are being created or even know they're out there. And just seeing that they're there and widely practiced kind of reinforces their value. But without the education, you're only left with experience to learn from, which is, you know, goes for anything in life. So, yeah. Unfortunately, you see a lot of people who have some, you know, some battle scars that will drive it.
Well, one of the, I mean, I'm thinking that our audience is reliability professionals or people interested in reliability. I doubt that somebody that was shopping for shoes picked up this podcast to take a listen to it. So we're probably preaching to the choir, to use a colloquial phrase, in some respect. But we know that each organization, that whether you've been tapped to become the reliability engineer for your group or you just joined a group, it's going to have its culture. It's the way that organization approaches reliability performance. How do they build it into their products? And it could vary dramatically across the whole spectrum of what we call maturity. But let's say you get into an organization or you recognize that reliability is important and you do a quick assessment, right? You look around about how and who's doing what tools and techniques and how the decisions are being made. And you find that there's a lack of awareness and understanding. So that would speak to the topic that you've mentioned it with your clients, is, hey, we need to do some training to get everybody up to speed. So that may become obvious, is to build awareness and then build on it from there. Whereas other organizations, maybe they have a long list of tools and techniques they're doing, and they're running around running all these reliability tests, and they're not getting a lot of value from it. And that might be the situation. So how do you break that barrier? Or each of those particular circumstances may have a set of specific tools or activities that you can do to help the situation to improve it. But is there some basic tenets that you've seen, Adam, that how do you change the culture? Because that's what I think I'm really going after.
Yeah. And there's definitely no direct prescription for it. It's definitely has to do with analyzing all the components of the culture that are there. I mean, that would be like saying, how do I improve my marriage, right? You know, you can't. There's books written on it, but it's pretty unlikely you're going to find your relationship in there, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, I remember when my daughter was born, one of my actually reliability mentors, who also is very experienced in that and in life, he always enjoyed giving me words of wisdom, you know, in life in general. And, you know, he had kids that were grown up and my daughter was born, and he said, you should know, he goes, in all those baby books, he goes, you're going to find out your baby's not in there. So I thought that was great, you know, meaning that everybody's case is specific and you know, you take in as much information as you can. And, you know, there's no, if you were to walk into a therapist's office, you know, they're not going to just say, okay, this is what you do. They're going to spend a lot of time listening to you, understanding, you know, making specific recommendations. And it's the same thing. You know, you can look at what can be done in a book, but as far as the actual plan for you, that's something that's always custom.
So you're equating reliability engineering to being a corporate therapist?
It's not even an analogy. In some ways, it's exactly that.
We might have to change the title of this one. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But I mean, when you're, you know, it's, well, only when it's invited. But, you know, with reliability culture, you are changing the way people do things. You're changing the way they interact with each other. You're changing what steers your decisions. So that's, there's no way you can do any of that and not be addressing human nature, right? Because that's really what we're talking about, not just the technical tools.
That's true. When you start working on behavior, it's really where we need to work. We can go off and probably get signed off to go run, you know, a bunch of tests or do a bunch of accelerated testing or do a bunch of modeling. But if the organization doesn't know what to do with that or how to use it, it's kind of wasted expense. So we, even if we get improve the technical side, it's a hard way to change behavior by sending out reports, for example. And to a lot of degree, what we do as reliability engineers, from what we talked about previously with training and awareness, is looking at changing behavior. So I totally agree. Now, I've seen it happen in one group that I thought was just amazing. Is we did an assessment. I did it when I was at Hewlett Packard. I did an assessment for this particular group, and they had a very strong silo structure. And so the program team was struggling with competing groups. The different departments were competing for the very little resources that they had available to develop this program. And so what I suggested to the program manager is that she and her technical engineering, our technical marketing engineer in team, they had some strange title for this group that did more of the technical marketing stuff, create a block diagram. Because Phil, and it happened to be his name, I think I used Phil in the last example, last episode too, but different Phil, was familiar with a block diagram. He says, I know what that is. And we talked a little bit, and he created a very basic reliability block diagram. It was a series system for this workstation that they were working on. And he brought it to the program team, and the program manager was on board with what it was. But what she did was just brilliant. She looked at the block diagram, and Phil had blocked out just basic assumptions of and field data that they had from the previous one for the different bits and pieces of the system. And I'll pick on power supplies because they're my favorite. And she looked at the chart and said, all right, power supplies, you have the lowest reliability right now. You're the weakest link. What are you going to do about it? So next week, come back to this staff meeting with three options, with how much it's going to cost to improve the reliability to some level. And we'll decide what we can do with that and balance that. And cost was their other big driver. And so they sat back down the week later, and the power supply folks says, well, we talked to our vendors. Here's some things we can do. We can increase cooling. We can buy a bigger system. We can do this and this. Here's the different price points. And then the team discussed what was the right trade-off to do. And so then the power supply implemented that, and they moved up on the off of the weakest link part of it. So the next lowest reliability group, the further components, she looked at them and said, all right, you're in the hot seat now. What are you going to do to improve this? And by being consistent with that and bringing it back to the team to create the right solution and balance the resources to improve the system reliability, she got rid of the competing for resources to solve local problems and got the team to discuss things in a more balanced way so that they could actually improve reliability where it made sense. Got rid of the problem of everybody trying to optimize their silo, for example. Mm.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's a really hard thing to overcome, the silo structures, because that definitely does not work with reliability.
Right. And what happened then, and their reliability later told me that the because of those discussions, it was the person that was in the hot seat or the one that was on deck, the one next to be the worst one, were regularly talking to them about, well, what can they do? How do I work with my vendor? What tests can I use to show that our system or design is better? And it created an incentive for the different department managers, basically, to get proficient with reliability engineering and to understand how these tools help them answer that question, is how reliable was their system. So it changed a very, very subtle thing. It was like a 5-minute segment in their staff meeting at first, and then later it got into longer discussions. But it was, here's a simple model. Here's the first estimates. What are you going to do about it? And then that drove coupled with the ability, they had a reliability engineer there that could help not just implement everything, but teach people how to talk to vendors, teach people how to analyze data, teach people how to improve a design, what are the different trade-offs there, and so on. So they kind of did an end run of, instead of doing a day offsite training, which may have helped, they were able to build it into their decision-making right from the start. So they went from a group that was really struggling with field reliability to one that was really, really doing well with one program, with one cycle of their design. I never did follow up, you know, 3-4 years later to see if that sustained. But I imagine it did, because they had such a remarkable performance. Unfortunately, they probably promoted all those people, the program manager. So who knows how they did. But that's one way I've seen it done. To change your culture.
Yeah, it's so great to see that too, right? To watch that transformation, and especially see it happen in a way that probably will sustain, right? It's if you can create an example within an organization with something like that, as you know, one small program or even a subset of a program, and then you know that can be shown. That can be a great education tool without everybody having to experience go through a lot of pain to get there mm-hmm. by just seeing. You know, looking at the difference, the, you know, the before and after.
Yeah, that's probably a subject for a whole nother podcast, is on the resistance caused by not invented here, where, well, that might work for GE, but we're different. Our problems are unique.
You know? Yeah, right, right.
And within an organization, it's harder to say, hey, that won't work here. Those people are us. They're very similar to our team. You know, we work together regularly. So if they can do it, maybe we can do it.
Yeah.
That helps a lot. But there's plenty of barriers to changing a culture. And sometimes it's finding that little subtle change. I call it a trim tab adjustment. Or sometimes it's training awareness. Sometimes it's they hit rock bottom with a big recall type problem and they say, hey, we got to get this right, and a change of a focus or priority. But you're right, Adam. It's always custom. There's a number of different strategies, but it's always custom. Yeah. So one last question for you, Adam, is is the culture ever perfect? Are you done?
Are people ever perfect? Are relationships ever perfect? Absolutely not. And the second people feel that way, you're doomed for sure. Yeah. Anytime you see that attitude and you can't change that mindset, they're done. It's over. You can think of a million examples of companies that did that, right? Oh, you know, we got this. And that's when you're just sitting there waiting to be, you know, what I call the sideswipe. You don't even see it coming. And somebody else who's hungry and figuring it out and has the mindset of always doing better, they're going to get you.
Yeah. And reliability is, I think I mentioned it in our last episode, is this, I mean, the Roseville site held this DFR training, this 2-day training class every 6 months. And it was just a fixture that was a regular offered class. It was well attended every time it was offered. And it just kept the reinforcement of the culture there. So there's, once you make some breakthroughs and you make some changes, it's time to get to work. It's not time to celebrate. I'd say, you know, celebrate in your own way on those victories or minor breakthroughs, but realize that that's just the start. That's really a lot more goes into sustaining a culture of reliability awareness and practice than, yeah, it's tough changing it, but it's also tough keeping it that way.
Oh, that celebration part's a very important part of the growth. I mean, without those milestones and acknowledgments and feeling of success, why would you continue on that path? So I think that that's actually a very important component, is to make sure that that is there.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You know, I've seen more like fist bumps and, you know, congratulations and stuff like that, and appreciation type activities. I haven't seen like a cake with the icing saying, you know, best reliability program, or you don't see those at the store very often.
No, if reliability is going well, then what do you need it for, right? You know, that's the you know, that's one of the pitfalls of it, is that when it's working well, nobody knows. You know, it's like being in the CIA. You have no idea how many times they've saved you because when they have, you didn't know it. You know,
that's so, right. That's right.
It's kind of the same thing. Yeah. But one of my mentors once told me, you know, he said, you know, the trick is that, you know, when things are going well, the executives might say, why do we need reliability? And when things are going bad, they're going to say, reliability is really screwing up. Why do we need them? You know, so
that's true.
You got to be careful there. It's hard. It's hard to let everybody know, you know, the value of it, even when things are going well.
Well, that's been a struggle for years for a lot of us. And it's a matter of recognizing what value you add and quantifying it and making that visible on a regular basis. So, yeah, that's probably a subject for another whole topic. I think I think I mentioned that three times today, so we probably should wrap up. We've just added three more reasons to come back to the show. But if you're listening, and if you any of these particular topics or ideas intrigue you, please let us know. Adam and I and the rest of the team on the Speaking of Reliability podcast really enjoy hearing from you and what questions you have, what you're struggling with, and what you'd like us to talk about. Not only will we try to get you an answer, you know, maybe we've got something written on it already, or we'll give you some ideas or clues right away to get you moving and help you answer a question or give you some ideas. We very much prefer to talk about things that you are working on. And so it's one way for us to make this podcast more useful for you in particular, but the entire group of folks that are listening. So let us know. And Adam and I, you can find us at reliability.fm. And there's the Speaking of Reliability podcast there, and you can leave a comment. Adam and I and the rest of the team are pretty much visible online, so you can look us up and drop us a line. And we'd love to hear from you. So anything to add there, Adam?
No, I think that was a very good conversation.
Yeah, unfortunately, we get started on one of these things and then I go, this could be 3 hours, but we'll try to. I'm shooting for this 20-minute window as being the optimum. It's the average commute time, from what I understand from some research. So if you're listening in your car, we're going a little long. So if you're idling in the parking lot, thank you. And we'll wrap it up here. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.